are listening to a free version of Majority Report with Sam Steeder. To support this show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
It's Thursday, May 16th, 2019. I'm Michael Brooks on a Michael Thursday, and this is the five-time award-winning Majority Report. We're broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On today's program, Laura Carlson. She's the director of the Americas Program at the Center for International Policy. We're talking about the first several months of the AMLO's presidency, Mexico's progressive president, where he's moving the ball forward on labor and wages, a new push to decriminalize drugs, plus Trump's war on refugees and immigrants, looking at the other side of the wall of the Trump administration's assault and white supremacy. John Bolton and Trump are in a different place on Iran tensions. Apparently, Donald Trump is getting fed up with Mike Pompeo and John Bolton's rush for conflict and catastrophic war with Iran. He's having a rock anxiety. Let's reflect on the fact that Donald Trump has more sane instincts than his two prime national security people. Let that sink in.
It's Republicans, folks.
It's Republicans, folks. Of course, also Trump is an unstable baby and has been rolled by his advisors before. Trump's immigration plan that he will run for on re-election is going to emphasize skills over family ties, even as new rules roll out that would strip birthright, disenfranchise children of LGBT families. Horrifying move. Over a million hit the streets in mass protests in Brazil against the Bolsonaro regime's efforts to eliminate philosophy, sociology departments, and savage science spending. They have Republicans there too, and they're meeting them with mass demonstrations. Donald Trump feels the heat as his trade war with China is hurting farmers. He readies a $20 billion fund, but some of that money has actually already gone to similar money has gone to bail out Brazilian agricultural oligarchs. As those ties continue, the Trump administration's also censoring and erasing references to the Affordable Care Act on federal government websites. The Missouri Senate readies their own fundamental assault, not only on women's health, but their basic sovereignty and rights with a new abortion bill. As Pat Robertson questions not the ethics or the extremism of the Alabama bill, the political and legal efficacy of it, contrary to credulous headlines. A toddler who was apprehended. Think of how disgusting that sentence is. We got a 2.5-year-old Guatemalan boy who was apprehended at the Mexico-U.S. border, died Tuesday night after several weeks in a hospital. Texas has used money from the Help America Vote Act to pay for its botched voter citizenship review. And the Met Museum will stop taking donations from the opioid crisis fueling Sackler family.
Protest works.
Bernie Sanders hitting the trail, calling out the oil and gas industry. Joe Biden heading to New York to gobble up oligarch money as his dreary corporatist coronation goes through the nation. And Elizabeth Warren, unfortunately, reaffirms her commitment to great green policies by anchoring it in ongoing U.S. military domination, which might echo her troubling votes for defense increases. All that and much, much more on today's Majority Report. Folks, the three of us are here. We have obviously a lot to get to. Donald Trump clearly enjoys nothing more than being in campaign mode. You have this dysfunctional White House populated by disturbed, twisted, really sick, grotesque people. Mike Pompeo, John Bolton, Stephen Miller, Sarah Huckabee Sanders. And then you have this, you know, this very unstable, needy baby bouncing off the walls. He does have an instinct of how to campaign. And I think it's really, and his perception of and the adulation of the crowd, I think is really the only part that he actually really enjoys about this. And his instincts obviously take him to xenophobia and every other kind of bigotry, as well as false populism. And he's taking aim at the Green New Deal. He's taking aim at ecological policies. Of course, as with every single Republican, Donald Trump has raged an unrelenting war on species, on air, on water, on basic public safety. And of course, his EPA head, I believe, recently just said he's not losing sleep over carbon dioxide concentration. But Donald Trump is losing sleep about one thing that has to do with the environment. Check this out. He's at a campaign rally in Louisiana talking to about the wonders of natural gas and his apparent huge affection for birds.
Under the Green New Deal, they don't like clean, beautiful natural gas. They don't like anything. They don't know what they like. They sort of like wind, even though it kills all the birds. You want to see a bird cemetery? Go under a windmill sometime.
He is such an idiot.
So it's true that birds are killed by...
the fact? Yes, so birds are sometimes killed by windmills, yes.
Yeah, it looks like terrible. Numbers, estimates, I mean, from a few years ago, it was about a quarter of a million.
Oh, that's a lot.
Sure, I just lost the thing. Hold on, let me find this again.
Okay, so basically, Donald Trump is going, of course, you know, as I say, this is an administration that is doing its all to strip away protections in every single environmental category. It's making it easier for coal companies to pollute. It's removing even the most modest restrictions on oil and gas. And of course, natural gas, I mean, I guess everybody is subjectively free to think of it as beautiful, but it is in fact also profoundly dangerous and environmentally harmful to water, for starters.
Yes, this was from 5 years ago. Wind turbines kill between 214,000 and 368,000 birds annually, a small fraction compared with the estimated 6.8 million fatalities from collisions with cell and radio towers.
Ooh.
And guess how many deaths from from cats?
How many deaths from cats?
2 billion?
That's just nailed it. It's between 1.4 billion and 3.7 billion. So,
Jesus.
Also, insane. Cats are good.
Cats are on a fucking rampage. Excuse my language. I'm sorry, but that's a lot.
Solidarity with the birds. Yeah. Forget cats.
No, I'm on Team Cat.
You're on Team Cat?
Team Bird.
Team Bird. I'm a bird watcher, folks. So
one
he's
cat,
back in mode.
One cat is like 80 wind turbines.
One cat is like 80 wind turbines. And meanwhile, the side benefit of the turbines is that we're not cooking our planet and we might have some ability to survive as a species. And actually, that same ability to survive as a species also affects the beautiful birds because they don't do well with choking on polluted air either and having the global planetary weather systems, the global weather patterns completely uprooted and destroyed by endless oil drilling and Bolsonaro's plans for the Amazon,
yeah,
supported by fossil fuel companies and Wall Street and, of course, Trump and the Republicans.
I don't think mass extinctions of different kinds of bird species is included in Trump's calculus.
Got to stay very specific. Very specific. All right, folks, we don't have any ads to do today, so I will just say that, of course, this show is made possible by you, over 90% by you, even as the ads roll in. So become a member today, majority.fm/become a member. Keep us free and independent. We're going to come back in a few minutes with Laura Carlson. We're going to be talking about AMLO. We're going to be talking about the border as viewed from the other side, as this, in this, you know, quite literally, I mean, a absolutely fake crisis, which has turned into a real crisis of human cost generated by the all the endless obscenities of the Trump administration with regards to the border. We'll be back with Laura Carlson.
Bless me, Father, for I have sinned.
I have to say that my brain is still in recovery mode from taking in so many high-level important ideas.
Part of your job is to listen to me.
Welcome back to the Majority Report. Michael Brooks here. Joining us now is Laura Carlson. She's the director of the Americas program at the Center for International Policy, and she's based in Mexico City. Laura, thank you so much for being here.
Well, thank you, Michael, for the invitation.
So I want to start by asking you about the Trump administration's war on refugees and immigrants as seen from outside. I mean, since seen specifically from the Mexican side or the Latin American side. We report on it on this show. There's certainly, you know, it's covered in the kind of mainstream media, I think, you know, very much in terms of the sort of different political calculations playing out. And there are some people who will, you know, call out the obvious racism and fear-mongering of the policies. And I think other outlets focus more specifically on how the crisis is completely sort of hysteria and self-generated and fake. But by acting from a place of this, you know, this fake crisis has, I guess, created a real crisis in terms of refugee populations and also people at the on the other side of the border, as well as people getting detained here. I mean, we did top line a 2-year-old boy from Guatemala just died after spending, you know, weeks in the hospital after being apprehended, which is just such an incredible word to use with a toddler at the border. So you've been covering this, you looking at this, you have a very deep understanding of it. What does it look like from the other side, as it were?
Yeah. Well, as you mentioned, that was the fourth child who's died in ICE custody. And as you mentioned, we've looked at the aspects of how this serves for Republican and especially Trump-Miller politics. We've looked at the aspects of detention, but perhaps, and I think this is very clear to everyone south of the border, the most important part of this policy is the downright human cruelty that it involves. Right now, you're talking to me in Tijuana at the border in Mexico, where I've been the last couple of days doing some investigation and reporting on what happens to these people, who's coming up, who's coming back, because as you know, there's a new policy now to send people back to await their asylum hearings and what kind of stories they tell about this. One of the most impressive things has been that the individuals are talking about the kind of treatment they receive after they relinquish, you know, they basically, the asylum process, it's important for people to understand because it's much different than undocumented immigrants. People are actually going to the border and they're presenting themselves to immigration officials and asking for asylum, which is an international right that's guaranteed under a number of different international human rights pacts that even the United States has signed on to. So these people are taken into custody, and they're talking about acts that can only be described as torture when in ICE custody. Particularly, there's a part of the process that's called the hielera, or the ice box in Spanish. And the ice box is where they literally throw people into a room that's freezing. And they keep them there for a certain amount of time. Their explanation for why this room is freezing is that it's supposed to keep contaminants or insects, or I don't know, some kind of, you know, again, that image of immigrants as a form of contagion. Right. And here we're talking about human beings, but they keep them in there. And we just talked to a couple of people who said that they were in there from 10 to 12 days, and they take their jackets in many cases as well. And then they'll be in there and they'll just be finally able, shivering, to go to sleep. And the agents will come in and wake them up, which again is a torture tactic, sleep deprivation, mm-hmm. that's used in interrogation and that's used in some of the worst authoritarian and totalitarian states in history.
So, and I guess I want to just, I mean, there's so much to get to, and you know, it just is appalling. It's disgusting. But what, remind everybody, I mean, what is the context for a lot of these people coming? And again, I think that's very important. I mean, it's one thing, obviously, there needs to be, I would support amnesty for undocumented people in the United States. That's another, I mean, it's a connected and linked conversation, and it's important. But these are people, yes, fleeing situations and going through a formal process of asylum. What are those situations, I guess, particularly in Central America, but there's also people obviously from Mexico, there's people from Haiti at the border. And what are the U.S. policy roles in those crises? I mean, even down to undermining some really interesting work that was done several years ago in El Salvador to sort of soothe gang violence that ran counter to kind of U.S. tough on crime policy there, quote unquote, tough on crime policy. What's the context? What are people fleeing? And, you know, and just to really underline that these are absolutely refugee status people.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's very important to understand each country has a different history, but there are common threads through that. And one of those common threads is precisely U.S. foreign policy in the past. U.S. foreign policy has created many of the crises of violence and other forms of violence that we talk about less often and that don't fit as neatly into asylum categories, which are extreme hunger, displacement, internal displacement, and constant threats from the security forces themselves. The violence we're looking at is both criminal violence and state violence. You can go country by country and break it down and see why people are forced to flee. And you hear it all the time. We hear it all the time in the stories that the people tell us about their cases. Let's just look at some very concrete examples. In El Salvador, yesterday we talked to two Salvadorans who have already gone to the United States. They've asked for asylum under the Remain in Mexico program, which is insane. They send them back to Tijuana, the most dangerous city in Mexico, according to the recent statistics that came out. And they're waiting here for sometimes their third, fourth, fifth court hearing to see what will happen with their case in the United States. One individual was drafted into join the Salvadoran army. He actually therefore became a target of the gangs. He actually has a bullet in his hand and another in his hip. And yet when he's gone up for his asylum hearings in the United States, they haven't even allowed him to present yet his personal evidence for why his life is under threat back in El Salvador. There's another man who said very clearly, if I go back from Honduras, if I go back, they'll kill me. I won't last a week in Honduras because of, again, a problem with gangs. In El Salvador, the roots of the gang violence in the United States are very clear. These are gangs that were bred in Los Angeles. Then there was a massive deportation program of Salvadorans, who many of whom had no experience living in El Salvador, and they reproduced the kind of violence that they'd grown up in with in Los Angeles. And it became an even more virulent form of violence in El Salvador, where the problems of poverty that are still, and the problems of fear and violence that are still a result of the death squad area, again, supported by U.S. policies, are very much still prevalent and felt there. And then you have these programs where they say, okay, let's try something that's not fighting violence with violence. Let's try something that looks at reinsertion, that looks at rehabilitation of gang members, that looks at giving them other options besides crime. And that was completely rejected by the United States government, those kinds of truces or other kinds of arrangement. And they still have a policy where they won't even talk about what to do with young people who are in gangs and how you can look at programs that would make them, you know, productive members of society. Yet when you talk to many of these people, it's not a life that they choose. It's the life that's been left to them. And then both them and the victims, because we're talking about, it's a huge and a blurry picture there, than the members of the people who are actually in crime, in gangs, their families, the way that crosses over into businesses, the way that it creates victims. You know, it's a whole structure in which oftentimes, and especially in countries like Mexico and El Salvador, you can't really tell even the good guys from the bad guys. There's so many people here in Mexico, government officials and security forces that are working with organized crime, that it's impossible to even draw the lines clearly there. Mm-hmm. Then you look at Honduras and you have U.S. support for the 2009 coup there that destroyed constitutional government and has created a situation where democratic institutions simply do not function. You can't expect the government, the police forces to protect you. And in fact, in many cases, they may be precisely the forces that are persecuting the people who are fleeing. There's daily demonstrations against what's considered an illegitimate government, again, supported by the United States of Juan Orlando Hernandez. And so you have these very deep structural problems in these countries that nobody's talking about, and the victims of these problems are being re-victimized as they come up to the United States seeking safety for themselves and their families and are treated as criminals or worse.
So, and in this moment, I want to transition to AMLO. So we have this, the direct link between, I mean, and obviously you can pull, you know, put these policies back decades and decades, you know, starting wherever you like, right? That they, U.S. coup in Guatemala against Arbenz in the 1950s, and now it's all sort of, or, you know, the reversal of the pink tide starting in Honduras in 2009 with the Obama administration backing that coup against Manuel Zelaya you just talked about. And now it's intersecting with this, you know, I mean, this acceleration, this particularly obscene Republican administration policy, which I always say, I mean, I think there's a strategic dimension to making sure that you keep a certain demographic in the electorate. I mean, I think that, you know, there is some real strategy here from a Republican political perspective. And then, you know, and I cover a lot. People will laugh. You can take your drink at this point. You have, a great president like Lula, I think undoubtedly in prison and politically chumped up charges, and this huge reversal in Brazil with Bolsonaro. U.S. efforts in Venezuela. And AMLO really is a distinction from that very negative trend. So not to, you know, glorify him or put him on a pedestal, but I do think a lot of us are looking at him as definitely a progressive counterweight and only and one of the only sort of potential political bright spots electorally right now in Latin America. Of course, there's always very powerful social movements. So maybe you could start, you know, we could go to several different areas, but I mean, wherever, I mean, how, but I'll just start broad. I mean, how is it, and maybe particularly in relation to these policies in Central America and this war on refugees and so on, how is your perception of AMLO's first several months in power so far, and what would be the main areas you think we should be judging him on or thinking about it on?
Yeah, well, since you started with the geopolitical, that this was one of the few elections in an extremely powerful country, one of the biggest economies in the region, that went left instead of going hard right, we can start there. And so what that means, so far we have seen a real shift in the geopolitics, mainly because, for example, and this is an important example, in the showdown on Venezuela, where the Organization of American States, under a right-wing Trump puppet, basically, Almagro is taking a hard line for intervention in Venezuela, and other countries are as well. The Mexican government has taken a firm stance for mediation and dialogue, and saying that it will help no one for U.S. intervention to try to resolve what's an internal matter in Venezuela. We also have Mexican government taking a firm stance against hardening the embargo against Cuba. And so we see real differences there. On the immigration issue, it's been much more mixed. The administration of Andrés Manuel López Obrador, AMLO as he's called, has been very, very careful about the relationship with the Donald Trump administration, despite the fact that it's been a Mexico-bashing administration since the campaign, that it takes every possible opportunity to insult the country as a whole. There's so much economic dependency between Mexico and the United States, and not just in trade directly, but particularly from financial markets. You know, one decision by the unelected and illegitimate forces that run the financial markets, and the peso can drop, and the investment rating can fall, and all of a sudden every plan for trying to create a stronger and more equal economy here in Mexico can go out the window. And they're very aware of this. And so this is not a justification. I think that they've gone way further than they needed to or than they should have in terms of placating an administration which could very possibly be called neo-fascist in the United States. But that's kind of what's happening. And on immigration, we see it, unfortunately, very clearly. At the beginning, there were strong declarations that they would be taking another tack on immigration. They'd be looking to the root causes. There'd be less crackdown. There'd be less criminalization. There'd be an effort to try to create a situation where people don't have to flee their home countries, whether they be Central America or Mexico, because there still is immigration from Mexico, and it's important. And there's still refugees coming out of Mexico as well. The violence has gone up here, unfortunately. And then after that, we began to see Trump's threats to close the border, and we began to see the Mexican government responding with more crackdown on immigrants, with policies that seemed very erratic between the declarations of human rights and what was actually happening to Central Americans who were coming up through the country. So now everybody, between Trump's decrees, you know, from one day to the next, that oftentimes people in U.S. agencies don't even know how to apply. And what's happening here with this ambivalence between placating the Trump administration and trying to, you know, respect in some senses human rights of migrants, what we have is just a real mess. Nobody even knows what they're doing. And there's thousands and thousands of families that are caught in the middle.
What? And then, so how do you take, as a really positive signal then in the last couple of days, this rejection of money for the Merida Initiative, I believe it's called, and this talk of reshaping, basically stopping participating in the U.S.-backed drug war, which has fueled so much of the violence and instability in Latin America. Not in the sense, obviously, they're connected, but not the same issue, but that this is maybe one area where in the first several months, the Obrador administration has been willing to start going in a direction of directly confronting, I mean, not only Trump, that would seem to me to be very bipartisan U.S. consensus foreign policy. I mean, a lot of this accelerated, in my understanding, under the Calderon and Obama in terms of this real radical escalation of militarization of drug conflict in Mexico and U.S. support for, you know, basically just these standard, highly militarized, extremely violent policies. So does that give you, I mean, first of all, what is he actually proposing? And does that give you some hope that maybe the next phase here might mean more confrontation?
Yes, we consider it absolutely good news that López Obrador came out and said the Merida Initiative is over. Now, just saying it does not mean that the Merida Initiative or the drug war are over. So we have to see what happens after that. But there have been grassroots organizations in the United States and almost every major victims organization, that is to say victims of drug war assassinations and the many organizations that exist of family members of the disappeared here in Mexico, have come out specifically against the Merida Initiative. The Merida Initiative is the vehicle for the drug war imposed by the United States on Mexico. It's the violence against violence kind of a strategy we were talking about that has exploded the violent rate here in Mexico to homicide rates that we never even imagined we'd be seeing in many of the cities across the country. So changing that strategy has been a principal demand of organizations on both sides of the border, and it's a very good sign that that's been announced. Now, for that to actually happen, we need to see a demilitarization of everything. And that's where there's been some questions. López Obrador announced a National Guard. The National Guard is supposed to be more civilian, and yet he's announced an army general to be the head of it. Mm-hmm. Now, there's some limitations on what the armed forces could do, because one of the first things that has to be done is the gradual withdrawal of the armed forces from domestic security. It's basic in the United States, and every major international human rights organization has said that the armed forces are trained for something different. They should not be involved in criminal policing. So we have to see how fast that actually happens. And then in terms of the United States, the Pentagon has really taken over, under the Merida Initiative, the U.S.-Mexico relationship. Now, there's a lot of organizations or a number of organizations in Washington, like WOLA and others, which is the Washington Office on Latin America, who have argued that the Merida Initiative is now a benign police and judicial training program, primarily because a lot of that direct military funding then went into international narcotics, where it was going to these programs. But what we see here in Mexico is that it's still a drug war, and it's still feeding the same violence against violence model that has caused so much human tragedy here in the country. Even when you're training police, you're training them in that same kind of a model, and there have been no positive results in terms of human rights or in terms of ending impunity here in the country.
I want to get back to AMLO's record in a second, and we can end on a focus on issues around social investment, labor rights, and austerity. But I just briefly, if we could go on this track for a second too, I mean, what is also the relationship between, you know, the various cartel factions and different political parties? And even, you know, there was reporting a couple of years ago that the DEA was sort of in different political arrangements with different cartels to sort of share intelligence and then maybe sort of, you know, treat them differently than others. Again, that's not particularly surprising or exceptional. I mean, we certainly work with heroin traffickers in Afghanistan. We definitely informally worked with, you know, the rival cartel of Pablo Escobar as an example. There's nothing particularly exceptional about it, but I think it also illustrates, if I'm right, and you'll correct me obviously if I'm wrong, the other dimension that we're helping fuel all this incredible violence when, as you said before, even structurally figuring out, you know, who is on what side and disaggregate. I mean, you know, the politicians implementing these programs forced by the United States could be partners with different cartels, and U.S., you know, foreign policy could be sort of informally aligned with different cartels depending on, you know, different arrangements. I mean, is that also a dimension of what's going on?
That's definitely a dimension. You know, I've done in-depth work on the DEA in Mexico and in Latin America in general. And I remember once I was interviewing an investigative reporter here in Mexico who has worked a lot on the poppy-growing region in Guerrero and other states, which is now, you know, one of the biggest problems with illicit substances. And he said, why do you think they call it the Drug Enforcement Administration? They administer the illegal drug trade. They don't fight it. They administer it, you know? And yeah. There were often times where it's not something that you can, like, smoking gun prove, but there were often times when we said, okay, you know, we can see that there's a crackdown on one cartel and a certain favoring of the other. That they're looking to be able to deal with either a larger cartel so they can have a single negotiation, or, you know, or there was clearly favoritism in terms of how that came down. And the DEA, by its way of working with inside informants, what they have is they will actually protect and encourage criminals within the organizations on the theory that they're going for a bigger fish. But sometimes, you know, the ones they're protecting are actually bigger than the fish they end up getting. And in the meantime, they're actually working with, you know, homicidal maniacs. Mm-hmm. So again, that good guy, bad guy line, it's completely non-existent in that sense. The reason that the violence has gone up so much with this model is also what they call the kingpin strategy. So the kingpin strategy says, okay, if we take out the leader of the drug lord, you know, the main guy in these cartels, then they'll gradually fall apart.
El Chapo. That's why everybody focuses on the El Chapo. And not only does it never happen.
And look what happened to Sinaloa.
Right.
The violence and the strength of the Sinaloa cartel after the capture of El Chapo was worse. Or even worse cartels took over some of their territory. And again, the violence always goes up when you take out a drug lord. Not to say that they shouldn't prosecute criminals, but you have to consider what the impact is on society. It creates instability. It sometimes fragments the cartels, and those smaller ones, they even prey in a worse way on the communities in which they have control than the other ones. So the impact, as they herald having captured, you know, in this macho language, another drug lord, the impact on communities and on civil society is terrible.
And they're also not, you know, it's funny because it seems to me like in the reporting and even in, like, you know, pop culture, it's like, there's this acknowledgement that these cartels are very sophisticated, that they're embedded in the global economy. If we get into, like, you know, how they wash their money, it would implicate, you know, and as in the past, I mean, we know with HSBC, it could implicate, like, major Western financial institutions. And so there's this understanding on some level that, like, these are just part of globalization. This is just sort of illegal globalization, and it's very sophisticated. It's very mobile. It's, you know, but then on the other hand, it is sort of like, oh, yeah, but I mean, if Jeff Bezos quit tomorrow, Amazon would still exist and Amazon would still have an incredible power. So there is that kind of funny contradiction of, on one hand, sort of emphasizing the sophistication of these cartels. But then, yeah, right. It's always, oh, no, if you get rid of El Chapo, then you're good. If you get rid of Escobar, you're good. When, as you said, I mean, not only not necessarily, it might even cause even further instability, and it won't disrupt these supply chains.
Yeah, when you look at the absolute lack of positive results from this particular, from the model, the counter-narcotics, the drug war model that exists, eventually you have to ask yourself, what are the ulterior motives here? Mm-hmm. Because nobody would consider, nobody would continue with a model that was so completely failed if there wasn't somebody benefiting from it. And that's when you begin to see what kind of contracts are coming out, the defense companies, the security companies, you know, the lucrative State Department and Mexican government contracts that come out of keeping a country in a state of permanent war. We have a war economy. We have a defense economy in many senses. Donald Trump is trying to increase that. And that's what happens with Mexico. You know, they were beginning to be afraid that there'd be a wind down in the Middle East, and suddenly the drug war appears as the new frontier in terms of who can economically benefit. And then also the Pentagon had long wanted to have greater penetration in Mexico, but even under the corrupt and authoritarian pre-government, it had a strong nationalist vein that didn't permit, you know, the United States government to be as involved in Mexico's national security. So when the drug war comes along with a very weak and contested presidency of Felipe Calderon, they just threw the doors open. And if you're the first thing that you'll hear about the drug war in Mexico is that the Pentagon's just thrilled with it, yeah, because they've never had so much access. So you see these Washington national security priorities being imposed on Mexico to the point that, you know, the Southern Command of the Pentagon is on the Mexico-Guatemala border, repressing immigrants that are trying to come up, because that's what the U.S. government wants it to do.
So, looping it back to the war on immigrants and refugees, how, in the last couple of minutes, what about on the sort of, you know, labor, increasing social investment, the sort of classic, because my understanding is that AMLO is some type of, you know, kind of good social democratic kind of left, sort of soft nationalist kind of political force. What about on just those issues of, if you are middle class, or certainly if you're poor or you're working class in Mexico, is your life starting to improve a bit in this presidency? Or is there greater room that's being opened for, as an example, independent labor union organizing and things like that?
Yeah, well, so far, I mean, there's some people who have seen immediate improvement. The minimum wage on the border, on the northern border, was doubled to create a strip where the idea was to try to keep more people from feeling that they had to migrate or attempt to migrate to the United States. There's also been a raise in minimum wage nationally. And the rest, it's mostly not being felt. There have been some operational glitches. Some of the pensions that were promised to youth and older people are still not being delivered, you know, efficiently. But supposedly that will come under control eventually. And in the labor, on the labor front, some of the reforms that are going into effect, yes, should have a very positive impact. You know, there was a huge problem, and there is a huge problem, with protective contracts, what they call. It's when a union, or kind of a fake union in a sense, goes in and there's a contract with the owners of a company that the workers don't even know about. They have no idea what it even says. And basically that contract exists to keep any kind of real representative contract from from winning in that workplace. So they're beginning to go after that kind of thing in terms of, guaranteeing more labor organizing rights. There's a possibility a lot of these kinds of changes are still at the stage of space, as you say, and of possibilities. And the one important thing, and this is kind of a concern is that people will have to continue to be organized and to pressure the government in order for this to happen. This is not all going to happen the way it should just from the top down. And the concern is that the López Obrador government so far has had a negative attitude toward organization of civil society and actually has been trying to close off, not through direct repression, but closing off some spaces for that to happen. So I think, you know, the one of the biggest factors in whether or not this can turn out to be a real progressive center-left government that becomes an example for the rest of the region is how organized and how much the people themselves push during the next 5 years.
Well, Laura Carlson, I hope we can continue having these conversations. They're incredibly important, and I feel like we covered a lot of really important ground, so I really, really appreciate it. Laura Carlson is the director of the Americas Program at the Center for International Policy. Laura, thank you so much for doing this.
Well, thank you. It's been a pleasure.
Take care. All right, folks. And yes, I could say with confidence that both on Majority Report and TMBS, more conversations with Laura Carlson, that like... It's really awesome when somebody can cover so much terrain, but then also, there's a lot of connections there that you can tease out. And I just thought she did that really well.
She's the Carlson you want to hear talking about Mexico.
That's true. I think it's spelled differently.
Yep, with an
but
E.
Yes, it's the good Carlson. There's the bad Carlson. We talk to the good Carlson.
We don't like
Carlson.
That guy.
We don't like that guy because frankly, he's a bad guy. He's got a frozen food air brain, and we don't like it.
And he uptalks.
He uptalks, and we don't like it. I mean, look, that is the context. You know, what is so incredible, before we even get into, like, what are, you know, these more complex conversations, and they're important conversations of borders and culture. And look, in the United States is a melting pot culture. Is a broad-based culture, even though it's also a white supremacist culture. But it's a good thing that it's a wide-based melting pot culture. That's a good thing. That's a strength of this country, undeniably. That's a liberal talking point. That's true. And there's also just another truth that most people, I mean, just take a way less serious, way less melodramatic example. We rightly note that. You know, look, if somebody wants to, leave their town in the South or the Midwest or the industrial belt and go pursue a career in New York or Seattle or whatever, if they want to do that, great. Salut. Go for it. But you should not be forced to do that because your economic base of where you've grown up is so hollowed out that you don't even have an opportunity to pursue what you want to do there, right? And vice versa. I mean, obviously, so many people are priced out of places like New York. Now, not even just the working class and the poor, but a lot of people in the middle class, because these are oligarch inequality cities. But we know that, like, you know, the long-winded way of saying, like, most people actually have an affinity for where they've grown up. So if you even had, like, the most, you know, and I don't, you know, I give no quarter on the concerns of people like Tucker Carlson, because I think they're paranoid and bigoted and ludicrous. But it's like, you know, you want less migration. I don't know why you would want less migration, but the only answers to that are setting up a situation where we're not terrorizing El Salvador or pushing the Merida initiative. And people actually feel like, hey, yeah, I kind of generally might want to stay. I mean, you know, I don't live in Massachusetts, but I like that I can go see my parents pretty easily. I think most people would like to not feel, you know, they're not walking thousands of miles with small children to, like, life optimized. It's basic human survival. And we are the prime instigators of those problems in a geopolitical sense. That's just objective reality. So, you know, any conversation, including also, you know, the liberal perspective that doesn't start there is ludicrous because, you know, sure, it's great. It's better to speak out obviously against racism. But then on the other hand, I mean, you don't think it's a form of racism that we've muscled through, you know, this obscene drug war in Mexico? Essentially, to, I mean, I like what she, the way she put it. It is to create new markets. It is literally to create. The defense is a huge market. It's a growth industry, folks. Anyways, we'll get to the fun half. And actually, and this is going to, because I do think we need to start talking about, you know, who, how do people vote on defense increases? How have people voted on the Trump budgets? You know, and I think how people are framing their plans relative to our impact on the planet. You have to think on some level, if you're a voter in the United States, you're voting on behalf of literally everybody on the planet. And that is not true of you know, somebody who's voting in Denmark. It's not true. Become a member of the Majority Report today, majority.fm/become a member. That's how the show happens. Check out justcoffee.coop. Fair trade, tea, coffee, or chocolate. Amazing, socially cooperative enterprise. Worker-owned enterprise. That's what we're talking about. Richard Wolff-style enterprise in the great state of Wisconsin. On the Michael Brooks Show on Tuesday, we hosted Emma Vigeland, presented a mini illicit history of the different ideological strains of the Iranian Revolution. In the post game, we had a huge amount of fun, as always, including the debunk with Ben Burgess. This Sunday, we're doing a deep primer on Iran. Next week, a primer and mini and illicit history of Hezbollah as well. Patreon.com/TMBS and Michael Brooks Show on YouTube. And tomorrow, people that aren't patrons can buy tickets to our Chicago live show, August 24th. Patrons have already gobbled up a bunch of them. We look forward to seeing you in Chicago.
Be my second straight fall in Chicago.
Well, August 24th is still, is that?
Well, it's late fall. That's the last time I was
there. Your second Indian summer in Chicago.
I saw a Cubs game last time. I don't know if we'll do that again this time.
I saw a Cubs game when I was in Chicago. That's funny. Wrigley Field. Matt, literary hangover.
The Song of Hiawatha by Henry Wadsworth Longfellow is the most recent episode. Yesterday, I had a really good day. I went to B-dubs by myself to look over my note cards for recording the Margaret Fuller episode. Sweet. Of the literary hangover, which you did last night. A fun quote from her is basically and this isn't coming out for another week, but I'm excited about it. She was the first female foreign correspondent for American newspaper.
Right.
Maybe any.
Probably not any, I guess. Maybe some Brits got over in America. But she was over in Italy for the 1848 revolutions, and she wrote this dispatch on April 19th. My country, meaning America, is at present spoiled by prosperity, stupid with the lust of gain, soiled by crime in its willing perpetuation of slavery, shamed by an unjust war, meaning the Mexican-American War, which Hawthorne himself didn't think was that big of a deal. Noble sentiment much forgotten, even by individuals, the aims of politicians selfish or petty, the literature frivolous and venal. To go back to the Hawthorne thing, he said, I don't think it's as much of a calamity as everybody else seems to think it is. Which is like, it's like the Mexican-American derangement syndrome, right? It's the conservative, like, I'm not going to say one way or the other on the actual thing being argued about. I'm just going to say the libs are overreacting a little bit.
And right.
It's fucking timeless. Sorry for swearing.
No, that's perfect. That's all right. There are only two F words. We have a ton of stuff to get to in the fun half. I just opened the IMs. Check out the Antifada on Patreon as well. I would actually also just want to say, in light of this episode, really do check out the Redirect, Ronald Reagan's podcast, Stephen Robbins on iTunes, and of course also on, and in fact first and foremost on Patreon. Really important show for understanding this stuff. We'll see you in the fun half.
My love, she says no, 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 no.
she says no, 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 no. 'Cause you're only afraid to me. Only a brother to me. She's a pretty little doll who says no, 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 no. Just a little doll, and she knows I love her so. If I ask her to walk with me, she shakes her head at me. She's a pretty little doll who says no, 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 no. All the that time through, she says no, 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 no. If I ask her to walk with me, why can't she ever see me? She'll say no.